This episode of Life and Books and Everything is brought to you by Crossway, publisher of the Sing Hymnal. This is being put out by Crossway and compiled by Keith and Kristen Getty, who have pulled together a collection of nearly 500 hymns that you can use in your home alongside the family Bible. Others may want to use it in corporate worship. There are classic and contemporary hymns, liturgical readings, plus psalms paired with popular hymns. There's some stories about hymns and prayers. And as you would expect from Crossway, it is very elegantly and beautifully designed. So I do not yet have a copy in my hands, and I am eager to have one and to use it and to look at it. I've seen some PDF versions, and I'm very excited for this book. So pick up a copy of the Sing Hymnal wherever books are sold, or learn more at singhymnal.com. We also want to thank our friends at Desiring God for supporting the podcast. DG is celebrating the relaunch of the book that started it all, Desiring God by John Piper, of course. Originally published nearly 40 years ago, the book is relaunching this September as a revised edition through Crossway. This is the book where Piper explores the ultimate source of pleasure, satisfaction, lasting joy in Christ. Summed up in those famous words, God is most glorified in us when we are most satisfied in Him. If you've read the book before, you'll want to still check out this new edition from Crossway, this revised edition. And if you haven't, or you've tried it before and it seemed maybe slightly over your head, now is a great time to try again. It really is worth diving into classic. If you can have a book called a classic by someone who is still with us, I think this deserves that title. To supplement the book launch, the team at DG has created a free content journey called Desiring God in the Dark, which explores the topic of joy through suffering. You can sign up for this email series at desiringgod.org/dark, and it will help you learn how God provides joy, even in very difficult circumstances. Greetings and salutations. Welcome back to Life and Books and Everything. Kevin DeYoung, senior pastor at Christ Covenant Church in Matthews, North Carolina. Just a stone's throw, almost a literal stone's throw, if you were a good stone thrower, from Charlotte. And I am joined by my somewhat special guest, familiar, special in each of our hearts, Justin Taylor. Colin Hansen. LBE has been off for the summer, but we are back, and as has been the custom, start off with a bang, maybe a whimper. We'll see how this goes. Justin and Colin, welcome back to the program.
Thank you. We feel very special.
Got to give the people what they want, Kevin.
Well, speaking of that, as you know, there are really two kinds of people who listen to LBE. One, our mothers, and two, not our mothers. No, there are those, and you may hear from them as well. There are those who say, well, thanks for LBE, I like it. And when you guys talk about college football, when you do your banter, I just keep hitting the skip 30 seconds button on the podcast. And if that's you, you're not listening to this right now. You're already gone. You're out to the content. And then, believe it or not, there are some people who say, I love to just hear the three of you talk about nothing. I don't understand or interested in football, but hearing three friends talk is an encouragement. So for you few people out there, we are grateful. Here's my question as we get started. So we came off of summer. You can talk about what you did this summer, but I'm also interested, fall, do you like, are you a fall guy? That sounds like a show. Do you love the fall, Justin? What's your mindset as everything gets started again? Summer's gone, fall is here.
Pumpkin spice cappuccinos, I just live for them. And warm orange blanket in the cool morning. No, I like fall. I don't necessarily get into all the accoutrements, but fall means football and cool weather, so nice break from the summer heat and the calm before winter. Jim Gaffigan had that line, "Fall's my favorite day of the year," which sometimes it feels like that, like just all heat and then it's snow and you get fall for a very short time. But other than having a yard that has an enormous amount of leaves, it's just nonstop, constant. You mow and then you feel like you have to mow the very next day. So other than that, I like fall.
Colin?
Who are the fall haters, Kevin? I mean, are there people out there who don't like it because maybe they think, well, that just means winter's coming? What's the story
Well,
here?
my wife likes fall. She's very nice. She likes all four seasons. But she there are people like her. She always feels a lot of sadness that summer is over. Summer's over. Our vacation's over. We gotta get to bed on time and get up on time. I have that regret, but also mitigated by it is a kindness that in Providence that football starts. So when football starts, there's a set, summer's gone because summer's fun. And then football comes, school comes. And like a lot of people say, by the time fall comes, yeah, you could always I'd be happy with another week or two of some summer weather and another week or two before school. But you're about at the point, yeah, we can't live like savages for the whole year. Kids need to go to bed before midnight, need to get up, need to have some rhythm, some routine. So yeah, that's the fall. We also have constant leaves. Of course, they don't fall here in Charlotte for a couple more months, and then they really don't stop. They're not all on the ground until Christmas often. So it's a different fall season. Fall in the Midwest or New England is a special kind of beauty and gift. I will say I have fall allergies. Can I play to type here? Everyone's, wow, I'm really surprised, Kevin. You look
Shocked,
like you were
completely
shocked that
shocked.
you would have. So it seems to get worse every year. I've tried different things. They just marginally help. That now it starts in August, and was one good thing about being up north. Things just all die a little bit quicker and sooner. So I do feel like August, September, October, November, it's at least that many months of just constantly going through half a box of tissues every day and eyes watering and never knowing what I'm going to sound like or how I'm going to feel when I have to get up to preach. So yeah, that's what I don't like about the fall.
The other part of fall that is the dynamic that we have to bring back to football is that this is the time of year where hope springs eternal, and every fan thinks this could be the year we could at least get to the playoffs. And
I don't think that. I don't
if
think
you're not a
Michigan
Michigan
State.
State, but most of us think, what if we just run the table? What if we just start winning and we never stop? Maybe the Northwestern fans don't think that either, but the
There's
Nebraska
something fans.
Fans.
special about Nebraska fans, i.e. delusional about Nebraska fans.
We have won the offseason every year for 10 years in a row, but this year feels different.
Somebody used the phrase Nebraska, quote, a dark horse college football playoff team. That's a very dark horse. I can't see it. It's so dark.
Well, Joe Klatt thinks that.
Yeah, well.
I do love Joe Klatt, but that does seem pretty dark. That's a midnight horse.
Okay, we're gonna clip this. Have your team there, Kevin, clip that
I
quote,
will.
and
Happy.
we'll come back to it in a couple months. See where we're at.
I will. I have many special Nebraska fans in my life. You being one of them. Be happy to see Nebraska do exceptionally well. It would be an exception.
It would be. That's true. I'll own that.
All right. Colin, anything else you want to give us coming out of your summer into the fall?
Well, it does change a lot depending on what region you're in, because I would, of course, look forward to fall because it means we only have 1.5 more months of searing, miserable heat before we finally get to a little bit of cooler weather. So I don't have September is like, I'm going to a football game and I'll probably pass out from heat stroke month. And then October is, I hope on Halloween I'm not sweating through, or my kids are not sweating through their costumes that were obviously made for somebody in Iowa. It's a different dynamic in there. But yeah, how could you not look forward to football and to crushing constant disappointment? That's fall. It just fits as the transition into winter comes and your hopes die along with all the foliage. So,
You've been in a unique position as a Northwestern fan and an Alabama fan. Every week you're half miserable, half elated.
It's quite a dynamic. I think when I'm probably the only person at the Alabama game who is watching on my phone the Northwestern game. And
guaranteed.
But the crazy thing is, I really have to adjust the way I'm actually watching the game, because it's like watching the people in slow motion in the one game versus the full speed version in the other. But still oddly emotional in both of them, oddly and utterly irrationally emotional. So fall, I can't wait.
Aren't they getting a new stadium?
I mean, not just a new stadium, $850 million stadium, which is 4 times more expensive than the next most expensive stadium built in history for college football. So that's going to be, and their opening game, I'm going to give you guys a guess. Who do you think Northwestern is going to open their new $850 million stadium to play against?
Elkhorn State.
Well, that's a good guess. Not correct. Justin, what's your guess?
McNeese State.
Okay, I have a sense of theme here. The correct answer is the Jackrabbits of South Dakota State University.
Right? That's what.
So I will
existential crisis.
A complete family meltdown. So I also have the responsibility and obligation to secure many, many, many seats to the opening of the new Ryan Field next year. So, oh boy, that's going to be a doozy.
Colin, you'll be glad to know there's someone in my RTS class I just started last week who's from South Dakota. I think he's way up in the northwest corner. But just the two of us in front of the whole class, I were able to have a nice conversation as everyone listened in. And I said with a straight face, have you been to the Corn Palace? And there was a student there who's from Germany. You know, Vati's... the Corn Palace. So that was a fun time. And then also we could talk about the Enchanted Doll Museum. So we were selling hard on South Dakota. I think we just initiated a church planting movement.
The northwest corner of South Dakota, that's no joke either. Yeah. That's some serious stuff. I drive 50 miles to school each way kind of stuff in that corner.
Yeah, since I've been 13, yeah. I've been driving myself.
Since I've been 13, I often have to have a town friend to stay overnight with because it snows for 8 weeks, and I won't be able to get home. Yeah, that's serious stuff right there. And the Enchanted Doll Museum, it truly is a land of infinite variety.
Well, yeah, I mean, who among us wouldn't want a whole room full of dolls and enchanted even better?
Haunted, enchanted, what's the difference?
Yeah, just some right. Justin, if most people are probably listening to this, if they happen to be watching, you look like half the man you used to be, Justin. So what's been going on? Congratulations, good job. And for everybody out there, I said, Justin, is okay if I ask you about this. I'm not being a rude friend, but you look great. You've been working out. What have you been doing to lose so much weight?
Yeah, it's only rude when you say, like, hey, look like you've gained about 20. So, I've been working at it since February and had a lot to lose. And by God's grace, I've been able to stick with a pretty strict regiment. And we could spend the rest of the time me going into details. You probably
don't
want me to
do that. But is it true you used AI?
I did, yeah.
So AI just... does the workout for you? How does that?
AI does everything. You just sit there and just like, I'm going to take a nap and let AI do all this. But no, one thing that I found with ChatGPT, and I guess I used Grok for a little bit, is, you know, it's not perfect. It's not infallible. But if you basically tell it, here are the people I respect, you know, make them kind of a team of advisors. What would they say? Here are my goals. And I found that that's actually been pretty reliable, because then they're able to draw not just on everything that's out there, but on kind of a specific philosophy or mindset. And so that's been helpful. I basically created a team of experts that I tend to listen to and follow and respect their work, and had it build me a program. And the baseline is called PSMF, protein sparing modified fast, which is what, I guess, in the 70s, if you go to the doctor and say, like, I'm obese, I need to lose weight, they'd say, well, this is what you need to do. So that's what I've been doing.
So is it mostly by input or output? Meaning, have you been mostly just monitoring what you eat, or is it mostly you're just hitting the weights and going to the gym?
Yeah, both. And I think I read somewhere that it's basically an 80-20 proposition between nutrition and exercise. I mean, if you want to go burn 100 calories at the gym, it's going to take you a little bit of time on the exercise bike to lose 100 calories. Or if you just don't eat half a donut, you can save 100 calories. Right. So I think it's easier to adjust the nutrition if you can stick with that. But yeah, it's really prioritizing lean meats, and that's my primary diet right now since February.
Justin Taylor, we have the lean meats. It could be your tagline.
Yeah, could be.
Maybe a book.
Yeah.
See if you can find a publisher.
Are you one of the last people who is doing all this work the old-fashioned way and not through one of the many, like, what is it, 25, 30, 40% of Americans are using the weight loss drugs now?
Yeah. I didn't mention I've been doing Ozempic every day for
that too. That as well.
No, I haven't done any of that, but and I don't know how people afford that. I mean, you know, no offense to anybody, LBE Ozempic listeners, but you know, I asked my doctor,
there
like,
goes
how
our
much
sponsor.
Is that? And they're like, we're sponsored by Ozempic and Pizza Ranch. Let them work out a deal.
Yeah. You could, if you could sprinkle cactus bread with Ozempic, that would be.
Yeah.
I mean, Ozempic's like $1,200 a month.
Really?
Yeah.
Really?
Like, I was like, if it's, you know, $25 a month, I'd think about it. It was like, yeah, it's $1,250. Well, I think I'll go to Planet Fitness.
I tell you, I'm going to Copenhagen in a few weeks, and I just plan to see this entire city overlaid in gold, since they're those weight loss drugs worth more than the rest of the Danish economy combined. That's how.
And how ironic that the people who have pastries named after them.
This feels like a racket, Kevin.
I thought you were going to.
This is a racket.
Yeah, this is. Would you like a Danish?
Colin, I thought you were going to say that you were really trying to work out to get ready for Copenhagen, which reminded me of, you know, Nate Bargatze had that little bit where he says, like, he was trying to lose weight for his 20th high school reunion. His wife's like, you're around me and our family and friends all the time, but you're going to all this effort for people you haven't seen in 2 decades. And
no, I did wonder, though, is Ozempic a lot cheaper in Denmark? Like, could you go there and you could buy it and then you could bring it home? I don't know. These are things that I wonder. But
yeah,
in all seriousness, congratulations, Justin. It is really, that is the harder way. Diets are notoriously difficult when you have genetic predispositions. It's very difficult to not get into those constant cycles. And the drugs have been helpful to a lot of people in that respect. Yeah. And I think there's a lot of validity to them. But if you can do it without it and you can save $12.50 a month,
yeah,
that's much better.
And you're right. If you're ever on a treadmill and, you know, it's giving you calories that you've burned and it's a rough ass. Yeah, it is. You're just going forever and tick, tick. It's hard to go through a lot of calories.
And I could throw this all away with like seven M&Ms. That's all it takes, you know.
I remember so back true. When I was doing more triathlon, and I'm no expert, just a weekend warrior, as it were. But I read all these books, and they're geared for, you know, middle-aged people and amateurs who are trying to be the best they can be. And all of these, I mean, you can spend a ton of money. All of this equipment, all of these sensors and power meters, and I have some of that, and what you can do on a bike to just get your aero design and get the carbon wheels and everything to just lose a few grams here or there. And the whole book did this, and then it gets to the end and it said, for 99% of you reading this book, this is all a tremendous waste of money, because you are spending thousands of dollars to shave off half a pound and just don't eat the Big Mac. You know, almost everybody reading this book, it'd be a whole lot less money to lose 5 pounds than hundreds and thousands of dollars. So yeah, good. Don't need to buy too many more of those books, and I'll just stop riding my bike anyways. All right, here we are. Life and books and everything. Books. We end that, we often save that for the end, but let's start with books. Justin, what did you read / listen to book-wise over the summer?
Yeah, I kind of have been on a Ron Chernow kick. I have never actually read a Ron Chernow book, though I have seen them all.
This great new writer, Ron Chernow.
Yeah,
you may never have heard of him.
Like, he's an up-and-comer in the biography world. Well, and they're so long that they're intimidating to read. Like, I just basically guarantee it. I'm going to pick this up, read two chapters, like it, but not like it enough to invest that amount of time. So I basically have spent almost all my gym time with Bible plus Chernow. So prior to the Chernow kick, I listened to Alan Gelzo's Redeemer President, which we've talked about many times. I had read quite a bit of it in print, but listen to that. And then
does he read it?
No. That would be good. I'm listening good. To another book. I won't mention which it is on Blinken and the Assassination, and the author reads it like, you probably should have gotten a professional narrator. Yeah. But Alan Gelzo would be better than virtually any professional narrator.
Yeah.
So then I went from that to Chernow on Grant. And then I've seen online most of Hamilton the musical, but obviously if I haven't read any Chernow books, I haven't read any of Hamilton and listened to all of Hamilton, and now I'm listening to Washington, and I understand why Chernow is popular and why he can get the masses to read pages, you know, books that are over 1,000 pages. He's very good as a historian, and he's very good as a writer, and keeps the narrative moving even though there's these massive biographies. So I'm enjoying that, and to, I guess, have maybe 15 or 18 hours left of Washington, which means I've listened to quite a bit of it so far. So those are some of my bigger reads.
Justin, does he have a whole team of people working on this stuff? How does he even pull these things off?
I don't think so. I think the secret is that it's all he does.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, he said, you know, I've read, you know, 60 volumes carefully of every letter and everything from, you know, from Washington, from Hamilton. So I think if that's all you do, 24, you know, not 24 hours a day, but if that's your full-time job, you can be quite productive, but most of us can't make that happen. So he's got the new big Mark Twain one out, and I don't know if I'll ever get to that, but
I know. Yeah, I'm tempted by that Mark Twain one too.
Yeah. And Twain and Grant had an interesting relationship, with Twain trying to help Grant publish his memoirs and kind of serving as a literary agent, which is interesting.
I had no idea about that.
Yeah.
Now, Grant wrote at the end of his life basically because he had no money, right? He lost all his money in investments.
He was not a great financial he was kind of naive and duplicitous, and got kind of tricked by somebody he trusted. And so he was writing it. I think he had a $10,000 advance, and the publisher thought they were going to sell a few thousand copies, and It became a literary success. I mean, I think it's widely considered the best presidential memoirs. And of course, since then, I think it's just presidents, ex-presidents sitting down with writers and telling them stories and letting them actually craft the words. So, and he was dying as he wrote it too. So
Cancer or
he only
something
had
like
a,
that? I mean, it's some
yeah.
terminal illness.
I guess if you smoke cigars like 20 a day, that's not good for your lungs. So,
Even in the 19th century, I think they knew
yeah, they still
that.
weren't
But yeah, they
still.
were like, ah, maybe cut that in half.
I was driving through the Bojangles drive-thru recently. I can't eat anything from there. Although if I could eat gluten, I could get into some Bojangles. But my kids like Bojangles. There are lots of them down here in Charlotte. And at the drive-thru, and I've had some interesting Bojangles experiences before. I've gone through the drive-thru before and say, well, they close at 8 and it's like 7:15. So I'd like a box of chicken. Hold on a second. We're out of chicken. How can you? That's Bojangles. You can't be out of chicken. But they were doing fine and pulled up to the drive-thru. Gen Zers, very much a Bojangles kind of ambiance. And I hear these two who are in the window, and they're talking. The girl says to the young guy, "Have you seen Hamilton the musical?" It's like, I don't know. I don't need to see that. She said, "You have to see. You've never seen Hamilton." So I'm just sort of listening in, and they go back and forth. And he just says, "I'm not into the musicals." He says, "How? Well, it doesn't matter. You got to see Hamilton." And finally, he just says in exasperation, "The only musical I think is worth seeing is The Sound of Music." So I leaned over into the window and I said, "Now that's a smart man right there." He said, "Am I right? Am I right?" "That's right. You see this customer right here, Sound of Music. We don't need to watch Hamilton." So no offense to the Hamilton. I know lots of people like it.
I thought you were going to say that he said I'd only want to see one on Witherspoon or something.
Well, that goes without saying. Colin, what did you read this summer?
So this feels like it's really up the alley of Life and Books and Everything. But the Why We Love Football and Why We Love Baseball books by Joe Posnanski. I mean, that is some good late night on your bedstand kind of reading. I mean, I've read Joe Posnanski going all the way back. I think it was to the 90s, but I don't remember. He probably started, I don't know when he started at the Kansas City Star. But it's crazy that they had two columnists at the Kansas City Star at the time, him and then Jason Whitlock. Imagine that interesting place. And I mean, I'm just reading about a bunch of bad Chiefs teams and a bunch of bad Royals teams by these two columnists. And then, he got his dream gig at Sports Illustrated. Sports Illustrated is essentially no more. I mean, it's nothing compared to what it used to be in online and that kind of stuff. But then, so you just wonder, what do you do when you're in your 50s or 60s or whatever, and you've been really a legendary sports writer, but there's really not much sports writing left happening anymore. I mean, for the last 10 years, probably. And started doing these newsletters and then turned them into these books. And I mean, I mean, what else can you say? They're just truly enjoyable. They're fun, they're insightful, they're informative, but they're just truly a delight to be able to read. So if you're looking for something late at night before you go to bed, the chapters are so short, so you're reading 4 pages on, last night it was Ted Williams hitting 400 in the baseball book. Just felt like that kind of season, because another thing about fall is that October is the best sports month, I think. I mean, it's only October or April where there could be any debate, but you've got the college football, major league, you got the other sports that are starting, you got the playoffs for baseball and everything. So good time to be able to read those books as well. For my other projects, I mean,
And you forgot to mention track and field world championships
well,
comes
you
up
just cut
later
me
in
off.
September. Yeah, okay.
Get to that, but we can't forget that at all. No, it's just a that's I think we didn't even mention that was maybe the best part about fall. But yeah, there were
Colin and I are more into the field than the track part.
that's true. That was oh goodness.
I often think, I mean, what a world. You can make a living, and I bet most of them don't make a whole lot of money, but throwing an 8-pound steel ball.
If you're throwing it, Kevin, you're doing it all wrong.
You're putting it. I understand. You're throwing a javelin. Like, how long have people been throwing javelins for all of history? It's like, what do? I throw a stick.
Truly the original sport.
Yes.
I throw a spear to try to kill you. Uh-huh. Let's make that an Olympic event and get rid of the killing. That's called progress.
All right. So what book besides that? I keep cutting you off.
No, it's all good. So, I mean, we could go a lot of different directions on this. I mean, I read a number of political books that are really interesting. I don't think we haven't talked about, this is a whole different conversation to have. We never talked about the book We Have Never Been Woke, have we? If not, we might have to.
I don't even know that book.
Okay, so that's by Scott.
Or are you just claiming that for the three of us? No, we have never been woke.
Also true. No, Musa Al-Gharbi, it's a university press book. I can't think it's Princeton University Press. What I'm noticing is, we don't need to get into all this, but what I'm noticing is a really significant pushback on the left from a lot of economic left-wing or even Marxist-type scholars. And so the whole argument there is that the woke phenomenon is elite overproduction. When there's an economic collapse, 2007, 2008, then the next thing that happens is you have this creative class of white-collar information workers. They end up inventing a whole new system of shibboleths to be able to police their ranks and to keep other people out, to preserve their leadership positions and their economic standpoint, positions to oppress everybody else, but they don't actually achieve material gains for the people that they claim to speak for. So that's the basic argument of this. So
who's the we?
Say what?
Who's the we in the title?
He's writing as an academic in an academic university press book he's essentially saying, if you look back on the last 15 years of this great awakening, it's never actually been about anything that it purports to be about. It's about elite overproduction and consolidation of the creative classes and their suppression of other people trying to enter their ranks.
So is he a Marxist, or is he just using, I'm not saying just because that's not necessarily Marxist, but it would be a kind of Marxist way to view class economics. Not saying that's the exclusive domain of Marxist interpretation, but
yeah, I would, I mean, I don't know exactly that. I don't want to put the label necessarily without a lot of information, but from what I see from him, it's actually very similar to Yasha Monk's book, The Identity Trap. Very similar dynamics in both of those books. And so, but yeah, the basic point I think anybody can grab on, and they can see that the left used to be about economic progress for all people. So how did it become the elite class of the richest people in the country, primarily focused on cultural concerns, not on economic well-being, especially for the working class? And keep in mind, he's writing this book before the 2024 election, where there was an even more significant shift in that direction. So yeah, some of the Keller Center fellows had read that book. Derek Rishmawi in particular had recommended it strongly to me, and I found it to be, I mean, obviously he's Muslim, we're Christians, there's going to be some disagreement. I'm not a Marxist, but it makes a whole lot of sense as an interpretation of what happened. So that was, I mean, it's very worthy of discussion. No, one that stuck with me for sure.
Yeah, it seems like it has some definite plausibility. I was wondering if the we was writing as a Muslim saying,
"Oh,
Muslims have never been woke."
Yeah,
which is true for Muslims, at least outside the West.
That's true. Yeah, no, the Islam is not a particular, he'll come back to it in the end, but it's mostly like, I'm talking about some Christian dynamics here, but I'm not a Christian, and just kind of explains that. But it's much more heavily dependent upon his cultural and economic analysis than any kind of religious analysis. But I just wanted, I mean, bottom line for this podcast, and why is this interesting among the reasons we talked about there, it's another academic press book that's pushing back against what's been so dominant in the academy for the last 15 to 20 years. That's noteworthy, I think.
I want to come back to that in just a moment. I think I can quickly mention a few books I read. Read Leland Ryken's biography of J.I. Packer, which came out, you know, before Packer's death. Crossway published this. We are reading this as RTS Charlotte faculty. We pick a book each semester, and it's interesting. The faculty always, you know, there's a poll or a vote, and with all the different disciplines there, you wouldn't necessarily think this, but the one that comes out on top is almost always been a biography or history. So we like reading biography. So I really enjoyed that. I hadn't read this before. And, you know, Ryken's portrait of Packer is personal. It's sympathetic. It's almost stream of consciousness in some parts. It's a lot of, here's several bullet points about this, and it's kind of chronological, but really more thematic. But, you know, it almost any time, though I didn't know Packer well, but almost any time we're reading something about someone we knew, or at least a lot of events and other people we knew, it's hard for me to put down and just understand different things. So I enjoyed that. A book I'm surprised I hadn't read before. I had it on my shelf and I hadn't read it, but a little bit niche. E. Brooks Holyfield, who's a great American religious historian, God's Ambassadors, A History of the Christian Clergy in America, came out maybe 15 years ago by Erdmans, 2007, so almost 20 years ago. It's really, 350 pages. It's an excellent academic, readable book. I mean, he does Protestant, Catholic, a little bit of Orthodox, and to try to hit the major theme. So as a Christian clergy in America, I found it very interesting. And then my wife and I have been, I can't remember if it's reading or rereading. I think for me it's rereading, but it was when I was a kid, so I don't remember any of it. We're reading through the Space Trilogy by C.S. Lewis. So I've done Narnia, you know, I don't know, 2-3 times. But yeah, I don't remember anything in the Space Trilogy. So read Paralandra this summer, and there are parts of it that thought, this is a little, I don't need any more descriptions of the trees and what the atmosphere smelled like. But then there were sections that were just really powerful. It is a setting, without ruining the book, it's on Venus, and it's the hero Ransom, you know, you can hear his name there, who's there trying to prevent a second fall, a fall in this world like the one we had in our world. It's philosophical, theological. If you're used to Narnia, which he wrote later, there's in more of a kid's book, there's much more action and things are just happening. These are a bit more philosophical. So now I'm in That Hideous Strength, which most friends I have say that's the best of the three. It's twice as long as the other ones. I've been enjoying that.
I would think, Kevin, if you have read That Hideous Strength before, you would remember that.
Yeah, well, all of the, you know, nice and all of the things, I mean, but they're sort of somewhat the intellectual furniture of different discussion. But yeah, I'm if I did, I was assigned to me when I was a kid, and it's gone now.
Well, I just read it for the first time, of course, just because of this book project that I'm doing, and didn't realize, okay, basically take the inner ring and the abolition of man, and that which come
and he
out.
Says at the beginning, this is right. Like the companion to the abolition of man.
Yeah, but there's a strong inner ring component to it as well, which he delivers. But this is what has struck me in this writing project that I'm doing, and it's always with this stuff, I think, because I'm pretty late to arrive with Lewis. I wasn't reading him I did read Narnia, but I wasn't reading this a lot when my teens and 20s and whatnot. But do you know which month that book came out, Kevin?
Didn't it come out in the middle of the Second War?
It's 38 to 45. It's August of 1945.
Okay.
And so it's the same month as Animal Farm by Orwell, but this is what just blows me away. At the very month of the end of World War II, ends up being the greatest victory in the history of Great Britain, two of the greatest British writers published dystopian novels.
About what they see coming.
I mean, that's the juxtaposition of that timeline is so significant. And I mean, I have a long essay that I've been that we're looking to publish at the Keller Center coming up soon about that Hideous Strength, because a lot of people would say it's really a 21st century type book. Mere Christianity feels a little bit more 20th, though it still has relevance in the 21st, but that Hideous Strength definitely feels a lot like the 21st century.
We want to take a moment to thank our friends at Greenville Presbyterian Theological Seminary for their support of the podcast. Greenville is absolutely focused on training pastors with a full commitment to the Westminster Standards. Their tuition model aims to be, here's how they put it, a burden for the lost, not a burden of debt for graduates. Thankful for Greenville and their support of the podcast. Jonathan Master is a good friend of mine. We've had him here at Christ Covenant to preach in recent months and am excited for the work that they're doing just to the south of us by a couple of hours. So thankful to Jonathan, the team there, and GPTS. I also want to mention Reform Theological Seminary. Of course, I have the privilege of teaching here at RTS Charlotte, and they have a number of campuses all around the country, and I'm so grateful for RTS. If you are thinking about seminary and you want to study God's Word more in depth, maybe you know what you're preparing for, or maybe you aren't sure what the end goal is, but you're wondering about seminary, and yet you think timing, finances, family, how could any of this work? Those are really good questions. Lots of people ask them when they think about seminary. RTS would love to talk to you. They have great admissions team, and one way that you can connect with them and get some answers is a free 30-minute webinar called Seminary at Every Stage of Life that they are hosting on Thursday, September 19 at 10 a.m. Central Time. So September 19, a free webinar where you can connect with people from RTS and explore this from the comfort of your own home or office and try to figure out if there might be a way for you to enroll at seminary. Talk you through what RTS has to offer, explore flexible programs they have. You'll also learn how 89% of RTS students graduate without additional debt. So go to rts.edu for all sorts of information and /webinar, rts.edu/webinar, to find out more about seminary at every stage of life on September 19. Here's something I've been thinking about, and I'd love your thoughts on it. And I didn't give any of these topics to you guys in advance, so this is all fresh.
Fresh is one way to put it.
Yeah, fresh, something. Was it 2019 that I wrote my piece on the splintering? No, it must have been after that, because it was, I think, was COVID,
it was
a part
COVID.
Of it. Maybe, 2021, the splintering of Reformed evangelicalism into the, and I did the four groups, and then others had similar analysis and had six groups, and so the numbers get confusing, but at least in our little tribe.
March 21.
Yeah, you pulled it up. Thank you. Have referred to some of that. Contrite, team compassion, team clarity, team courage, the four terms I gave. And I intentionally tried to give terms that were positive. I've since said, hey, if people want to look, they can see that, you know, I'm really there as a three, hence clearly reformed. I mean, that's without negating truths that are in the other three buckets. So when you do an analysis like that, I think there's two different approaches. You can either try to say what's the right approach, or you can try to have an explanatory purpose, which is what I tried to do, and say, I'm not even going to try to argue for one or the other, though I don't think all options are equally good, but just try to give some labels that people in those camps would say, yeah, that kind of describes how I see things. Since then, a number of people have said, Kevin, I think you should update that. And I've had that. I've tried that at some times, and I have discarded drafts, and it's rattling around in my brain. And I do hope to do that at some point. But here's one of the categories, maybe not a new box of the four, but at least how it would lay over those four groups. And I do think by now there might be five or six groups, not just four. But here's one of the big issues as I see it. What is the state of the world? Now, that's a huge question. Let's say, what's the state, what time it is, to use the phrase? What's the state even of the West? What's the state of America? Because you can, it's a very big world. It's a very big country. And we have different experiences. And because the internet gives us access, seemingly, to anyone everywhere and all their experiences, you can just rattle off, if somebody says things aren't that bad, you could in minutes rattle off five or six terrible examples. You know, a school board here who's doing something, a raising of the pride flag over here, someone in some part of Western Europe thrown into prison for free speech, what we would call free speech. So it's really easy to come up with that. And so you have some people would say, look, you, Western civilization has fallen, it's crumbled, or it's under attack. You have no idea. You're just pie in the sky. So if that's sort of, we are absolutely under constant attack and maybe defeated, that gives a sense of urgency. It gives a sense of, hey, you're trying to play by old rules. You're trying to do things that worked maybe in the neutral world. You're trying to do things that worked in, you know, back when liberal democracies worked. So what time it is? On the other hand, somebody could very easily say, hey, look, the Supreme Court has, I mean, they've been on a roll, not every single decision, but defending religious freedom, for example, and winning case after case. And just on a local level, I hear lots of pastors, though there are struggles, saying, boy, I'm seeing my church is growing. I'm seeing a new hunger. I'm seeing a new interest in Christianity. So how do you think of, and is it even an answerable question? And if it's not, how do we get past that? Because that seems like a major impasse that is really more felt than even strictly argued. What time is it? How are things going? You're really good at these macro level analyses, Colin. How do you think of that?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question, Kevin. What's helped me here and is thinking about the different layers of history. Andrew Wilson had taught me this based on some historiographical work in the 20th century. It was understand that history develops on at least three different levels, and you think of it as the ocean. And so the everyday events are your surface, the waves bobbing up. Then you've got a mid-level of kind of what's happening, every major political changes, vibe shifts, you might even say, they're kind of woke to, you know, post-woke, whatever, things like that. Then there's the bottom layer of stuff that's civilizational type level. What I find is that most people are thinking about things at the top level or maybe the medium level, and there are not many people who are thinking about the bottom level. And so,
because it's a lot harder to do.
It's a lot harder to do. Requires a depth of insight, to keep the metaphor here. Also, especially an awareness of history and awareness of the cycles of history, kind of the ups and downs, but also those cycles. And what I often will find is that I'm more pessimistic than most people about the bottom layers. So when it comes to what's happening in Western civilization, the underpinnings, and this is what's interesting, if I want to borrow here from Tim Keller, a lot of people would associate him with being fairly positive about engagement. But when it came to the deepest layer, he was completely negative about the underpinnings of Western civilization and their ability to be able to hold or cohere or to be able to sustain us moving forward apart from Christianity. So I would share that basic perspective that I'm probably a lot more negative than a lot of people are. And by the way, the work that I'm doing right now, the stuff on Lewis, the stuff on Churchill, is exactly trying to sort through that question of where are we in terms of the civilizational crisis. At the same time, I think that where we fixate a lot on the this is what's happening with this school board, or this is what's happening over here with this pride flag, or this, the Supreme Court decisions, I think, are a bigger deal. I think that I would put those at the middle level. But I think we're too prone on the top level to see things as, I mean, those are really ephemeral type things. And Kevin, I'm in a similar situation to you. There's always bad stuff to find on the internet, but the churches in my community can't find enough space to fit all the 20 somethings in their churches. Like we have a church building crisis. So, and now that's just my city. Maybe that's not happening anywhere else, but I think there is evidence that it's happening in other places as well. So I just always tell people, just be careful about somebody who's telling you that everything's changed when really they're just kind of talking about a wave on the surface. It goes up and it goes down. Try to pay more attention to what's happening underneath. And that's, I think, Kevin, where I have a lot of concerns for sure.
And to follow up on that analogy, let's say what people are seeing on the waves, there are some big breakers out
there. Oh, absolutely.
There are some really nasty waves. Mm-hmm. But to use that analogy, it's helpful because so often then the response is, well, if you want to do something, you better make a huge splash right now, kick up as much. So it's fighting a wave with a wave, and there may be some value in that at times. Just suppress the analogy. If your house is going to be destroyed by the wave, yeah, you push back on that wave. But if we only think in terms of just kicking up more foam on the surface, and that's often with, well, you're not engaged, you don't care, you're pietistic, passive, you're acquiescing, you're defeatist. Well, maybe there's a way to be working on that middle level or even deeper things, which are going to take a really long time. And it's always the push and pull or the tension between how much is what's required of us normal, ordinary faithfulness, and which certainly is one answer. And then at which point might, hey, we just have to be faithful, be an excuse for not getting in the fray, not wanting to have anybody get upset with us. And yet when I look at scripture and the concerns that I see, like I keep having in my head, I want to write sometime, living in the negative world in the first century, and I want to look at the book of Revelation. Now, what did that look like? Because our world, however bad it is not, in most parts, as negative as what they faced there. And I'm on record as I mostly appreciate Aaron Wren's Three Worlds of Evangelicalism, and you guys may be less sanguine about parts of it, and I wrote a review for it. One of the things I appreciated about the book was Aaron really comes down and his prescriptions struck me as pretty ordinary in a good way about investing in your community and your family and your church. And they were not revolutionary. I think that's another thing. You talk about conservatives traditionally have been not revolutionaries. Even we call it the Revolutionary War, but it was not that kind of, it was very different from the French Revolution. Conservatives have been, we have something not to overthrow, we have something to preserve and to conserve. So it is difficult, and I find, you know, the hate that I get on Twitter, but I repeat myself because that's all anyone gets on Twitter, that's how it works, and I don't look at it much, but all, you know, most of it has to do some level of squish, you don't know what time it is, they're coming for our children, they're transing our families, and Well, yeah, those are bad things. But what's actually happening, and how do we make a difference as Christians? And what is the mission of an individual Christian you might be called to versus my role as a pastor in a church? There's a lot of different layers to it. Justin, what do you want to jump in and add?
Yeah, great discussion. And I think that one of the problems that we have is having the discussion and trying to reach conclusions without talking through the methodology. You know, what are the criteria that we're using? What are the definitions that we're using? If you have a theory that's essentially unfalsifiable, if all evidence counts for it and nothing counts against it and nothing could count against it, then you're not really doing honest work. You're just doing vibe work. And, you know, I don't know if you guys have mentioned the word vibe. Maybe you mentioned it at one point, Kevin, but I do think that's a big part of this. Is it's kind of more how we're feeling, what it seems like, rather than rational, definitional arguments per se. And I think that there can be something to that. Like, we feel something in the air, something's changed, dynamics are shifting, and then we need to investigate and articulate. I do think the diversity thing, and I don't mean by diversity, ethnic or gender diversity per se, but just the diversity of the size of the United States is a significant factor to think through. You know, that struck home to me in COVID. I'm on Twitter during COVID, and you just think we're all in the United States, but the way in which Iowa is a red state that was more conservative and, you know, less in favor of draconian lockdowns just felt very different than somebody living in California. And so I think the geographical size and diversity of the United States should give us some humility. It's hard. We haven't mentioned Trump's name, I don't think. And it's really hard to have the conversation without Trump, because I think when Aaron Wren's article came out, conservatives were like, yes, this is the key that unlocks everything that's been happening. We're living in this this terrible negative world. And then now it feels like the vibe is more, all we do is win. We're just victory after victory. And Trump has affected all of these cultural things that a lot of Republican presidents left to the wayside. So there's a lot of different things happening, I think. And I think if we can agree on terms, agree on methodology in advance, I think that helps things. And then the last thing, if we need to talk about Trump and Wren, we need to talk about the church, because, you know, as Colin intimated, the church is the hope of the world. And it's because the church is united to Jesus Christ, and he's Savior and he's Lord. And so I think it's helpful to kind of keep our wits about us, that with all the things that change in culture and trying to figure out where's culture going and what's happening and what sort of vibe shift, the thing that's not shifting is human nature at its root. Regeneration hasn't changed. The nature of sanctification hasn't changed. God's word hasn't changed. The necessity of prayer and humility. So I think that ends up, this final thought is that ends up being a pretty significant dividing line on the conservative side of things, is those who see the negative world and think, I don't like it, but we need to stick to means of grace, church-based, gospel-centered theology, versus those who think, yeah, but we also need to win, and we can put aside some of the speech codes of the New Testament that it commands us, and the ends justify the means, and we need to fight fire with fire and those sort of things. And I just, ultimately, that's not the way of Christ. He calls us to follow him, pick up our cross, and be with him every day.
Yeah, I just want to build on that for a second, Justin, because my concern this entire time with this whole discussion has been, the Bible is what norms our experiences, personally and in the world. And I don't think anybody can read the Bible as something that is of God being out of touch with the difficulty of life in this world, the difficulty of principalities, of powers, of princes, of personal life, on and on and on. It just seems the Bible is the most realistic of any book or any source you could ever find to help you understand. And Kevin, I couldn't agree more with that the negative world of Revelation. I was just talking with a pastor friend last night who said, it really helps my pastoral ministry when I remember that Paul was having to say, hey guys, how about you stop the orgies?
Right.
Like, how about we just stop those? I mean, look at the New Testament church, look what they're dealing with, and then look at what Paul prescribed and divinely inspired in there. The other thing, I mean, the Bible's that's what matters first. And of course, you look at a deep understanding of history, and a broad understanding of history also gives you a lot of context to not overreact, I think, to some of the things that are happening again at these top two levels of history. But the last thing to mention, I've come to describe myself in my politics, I often describe myself as a localist, but I've often, another term that I use, and of course, Kevin, well, you guys will both recognize this, but anti-revolutionary. Mm-hmm. Because a lot of what passes as conservative is really just a different form of a revolutionary approach. And this is one thing that when you see C.S. Lewis and you see him pick up on Leo Tolstoy and you see him also drawing in from Dostoevsky, you realize that all of them, they were living in an age of revolutions. And specifically, you're thinking about communism for most of them. That hideous strength, of course, is in part mm-hmm. just like Animal Farm. It's an anti-communist tract. But what they all share in common is a sense that when you're rooted in the eternal things, the things that don't change, it prevents you from, and this is very Burkean, of course, going back to that era as well in the 18th century, it roots you in a sense that there's nothing that justifies, let's just go out there and blow everything up. And like you said, Kevin, even a revolution can be something about recapturing something or preserving something. That's what makes the American Revolution different from the French Revolution, mm-hmm. which Edmund Burke recognized. And of course, it's the difference was in part that Christian anti-revolutionary mentality that was inculcated in a lot of those writers at the time. So, I mean, I just to sum up all of that to say, I just don't think we're paying sufficient attention to the biblical resources, number one, and spiritual resources we have, then historical, but even the great literary heroes that have guided, that can still guide us through where we've been in the past and what it bleeds over into our present.
So that's really well said. And I'll use that to transition to a last topic very briefly, but I think it's related and it's a positive view and it's a churchly view. I went to John MacArthur's funeral on Saturday and, it's a long ways away from North Carolina. I had to take a red eye, landed in Charlotte at 5 a.m. so I could teach Sunday school and so I could preach. And so I debated whether or not to go, and I'm really, really glad that I did. And any of our listeners, you can watch the whole thing. It was almost 3 hours, and you had to get there an hour early. So, I mean, it was a four-hour, ordeal is not the right word because that's negative. It was a four-hour event. But even if you don't have time to watch the whole thing and, listen to the hymns, but you have the Gettys leading the hymns. I mean, it was beautiful. Mm-hmm. It was edifying. It was inspiring. And, listen to Johnny Erickson Tata's remarks, eulogy on John MacArthur, or listen to John Piper's 15 minutes, or listen to John's, his sons, or listen to Sinclair preach. There's so many good elements. But here's one of the things that I appreciate, besides all of that wonderful content and message and celebration of MacArthur's faithfulness and expositing the word over all those decades, it felt like some of those good togetherness vibes that used to be more common, and maybe there's a way for them to be common again. Now, to just be together isn't necessarily a good thing. That's why it was together for the gospel. Just to have a coalition, coalitions for all sorts of bad things, but a gospel coalition is something different. I think I've commented before that even the names in the sort of late 90s into 2000s spoke of tribes coming together. You have Alliance of Confessing Evangelicals, Together for the Gospel, the Gospel Coalition. It was an era of other Reformed evangelicals finding each other, saying, hey, we got differences we don't want to pretend aren't there, but with everything going on, I think we're on the same team. And, you know, a lot of that's gone and has splintered. And some of it has just been hidden because I think people feel like, well, I can't show that I still kind of like that person or I'm friends with that person. And some of what was exposed was, yeah, sometimes the unity was thin and it was ephemeral. So all of that as an analysis is true. But, you know, I ran into, you know, I talked to John Piper and Wayne Grudem. I saw Vody Bachum. I saw Paul Washer. I saw Johnny Erickson Tata. I talked to Chris Larson and Bob Godfrey and Vesta Sproul and Sinclair. And I'm not mentioning these names that every one of them wants to agree with the point I'm going to make. And I know some of them well and know some of them just as acquaintances. But what a sweet thing, and sometimes it takes funerals like that, to see all of these people together who are willing, I think, by their presence to say, even if you disagree with MacArthur on some things, he preached the Bible really well, verse by verse, with lots of fruitfulness for 50 plus years. And he believed the Bible was inerrant. He believed all the essentials of Christianity and evangelical faith. And that's the team that we're on. Important differences for sure. That alone would have been worth the trip. And I could mention saw Alistair Begg and, you know, dozens of other people that I saw and had a conversation with, short or long. So my final question to you guys is it only funerals as some of these giants pass by? Is it only funerals that will allow that? What would it take in a right way, not just a feel good, paper thin, but in a right way? Will some of the tribes come back together? There'll be a realignment, no doubt, but is that possible? What would it take? What would it look like?
I think anything's possible with the Lord. I don't mean that just to be, to be the Sunday school answer, but, you know, Paul does say, it's one of my favorite verses because it's so hopeful and it's so realistic, that insofar as it's possible, live at peace with everyone, which implies it's not always possible. There are sometimes times when we might be willing and others aren't willing to reciprocate, but it is aspirational and it should be something I think that we think about and something that we should, within our power, do what we can to make happen. I think of it in terms of three levels. The ultimate is heaven. You know, do I expect to see this person in heaven? Don't ever want it to be like, oh, this is awkward to see somebody in heaven. You know, second level down, the closest to that is funerals, because you're celebrating the life of somebody who's just entered into his rest and his reward. And that it just tends to get rid of some of the gamesmanship and the pettiness when you're celebrating a life that's well-lived despite disagreements. And then you have the next level down. It's just everyday life. You know, do I have the motivation to repair relationships? And again, you know, we talk about kind of national politics and local politics, and I think the same can be true of evangelicalism. There's kind of national and international evangelicalism, and then there's just local, you know, where am I at in terms of my responsibilities and my friendships and the like. My guess is that there will be some coming back together, some realignment. You know, there has been a definite splintering. It's probably overstated at times, but I think if we learn anything from history is that these things tend to operate like pendulums, and they don't just keep going in one direction forever. So I think hopefully as we mature, hopefully as eternity seems closer than the day before, you know, there are some real differences. It's not just all tribalism and pettiness, but there are some things probably we need to overlook and take some proactive steps and try to put the gospel central and see what the Lord does. At the end of the day, again, we acknowledge what Paul says of, it may not be possible, but let's at least make an effort. Because it is a big deal according to the New Testament, the unity that we want to share in Christ.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think, Kevin, it helps that we've seen as we look back on the last 5 to 8 years that there were some individuals who were insinuating themselves into situations for the purpose of sowing discord and distrust. They were actively, outwardly, they were doing one thing, but privately, they were doing another. And with the way social media works, I think that can make a big difference, unfortunately. So maybe some awareness of that and maybe some stigma against that would go a long way. But I think going back to your original article, Kevin, which continues to be paradigmatic and helpful to me and many others in so many different ways, what stands out to me is that in those four categories, it can often be a tendency on the two sides to have an activist mentality. You're pushing, you're changing, you're accusing, you're dividing. Now, that's not always bad because sometimes an activist needs to call people out for different things that they're doing that are wrong, and that could be across the spectrum. The inward two groups that don't always agree on things, I think, have a more institutional type mindset, more of a we're building something, we're trying to do something together here, and we don't always agree. And I've always said that as long as those two groups continue to see that there's a benefit to doing this in Justin's terms of biblically and spiritually, but also just institutionally, we're a lot stronger together. And what unites us is, and just like Don Carson always talked about, being prophetic from the center, a center-bounded set, what unites us is stronger than what divides us, and we're pulling in toward each other. I do think that what I've seen is some of the activist mentality remains there, and it remains significant, and it's appealing for the same reasons that I just pointed out in the previous conversation. It has a revolutionary feel to it. It has a sense of, I'm changing everything. The old stuff is gone. It doesn't work anymore. The new stuff is here. That's what I mean when I say an anti-revolutionary perspective. It's very intoxicating, but it can be very powerful in good ways, but ultimately it tends to be very destructive. So I think, Kevin, that unity is very much possible, the coming together is possible around people of goodwill and good faith who don't have to agree on everything, but recognize that we're building something together institutionally, both individually, in our churches, ultimately that's what God calls us to, but hopefully even more broadly than that, as we've seen in this last generation.
Yeah, very good. I'll just add this as the final word. You mentioned Don Carson, one of his famous lines. He said, "My students don't learn what I teach them. Right. They learn what I'm passionate what about, what emphasize. I'm excited about," or we might say, what I emphasize, or what we celebrate. You can look around and see people that, maybe somewhere in the attic of their mind, they have the same statement of faith that they've always had, and they've never come out to say, "I now disavow this earlier statement." And yet, that does not seem, at least from what you can see from a public platform, does not seem what animates them, what gets them excited, what gets them up in the morning. The people that bother them are the people that actually stand for those things that they say they believe in. So we can't control how people will want to define us, but we do have control over what we want to put out there and what, at least to those closest and fairest to us, what we can be known for. And it is, we're going to do lots of different things, but it's hard to be known for six different pursuits. So so MacArthur, he wasn't shy about it. He made all sorts of statements. He had opinions about yoga, and he withstood his ground on unmasking things. So it wasn't, no one accused MacArthur of not entering the fray. And yet you can fairly say, if anybody, what was MacArthur about? He was preaching the Bible and verse by verse. And that's what he did. And I think part of the, if there is going to be a right gospel kind of togetherness, is to say, well, what do I really want? What do I want to talk about? What am I most passionate about. And I do think, although there were unhealthy things and some things that fell apart, I think at its best in the resurgence moments, it was a lot of people saying, I want to talk about the doctrines of grace and the inerrancy of the scriptures and the glory of God and the lostness of people without Christ and the need for evangelism and missions and yes, and local churches and expositional preaching. And if that's what you're about and that's what you want to talk about and that's what you're passionate about and that's what you see as a need for the world, this classic historic faith, and you want to defend penal substitution and propitiation and inerrancy and the doctrines of grace, that's my team. And I hope that people on that team will celebrate with all the appropriate caveats those who are advancing the mission to that end. Thank you, brothers. Thank you to our listeners. Thank you for all those who follow along. We are back. I'm not sure what the cadence will be or who all will be on the program, but Lord willing, later we will have Colin and Justin back. The airing of grievances at Christmas, for sure, if not before that. So until then, thanks for listening to Life and Books and Everything, a ministry of Clearly Reformed. You can get episodes like this and other resources at clearlyreformed.org. Until next time, glorify God, enjoy Him forever, and read a good book.